Okay, it's kind of embarrassing how bad I am at budgeting.
Let me see your charges.
Fine.
You spent over $600 on takeout last month.
I can't cook. You know this.
Yes, I have had your disgusting food, but you're literally paying for a meal subscription on top of that.
Whoa, wait. That can't be right.
Look, just get Rocket Money. It shows you all of your expenses in one place and even tracks your subscriptions. And if there's a subscription you don't want, which for you, there are a lot you don't need, you can just cancel right in the app with a few taps.
So you mean I don't have to call anyone to cancel?
Nope. No hold times or anything. And they'll even try to get you a refund on some of the months of wasted money, which is a lot of money for you.
Okay.
And if you thought I was done, I'm not. The app can also help you make a budget that works for your income. Anytime you get close to your spending limits, it alerts you, so you know exactly where your money is going at all times.
All right, I'm in. What do I have to do?
Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple or Google Play stores.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
Hi there, folks. Welcome to the podcast, The Lotus Eaters, for Friday, what's the date today?
23rd.
23rd.
Goodness.
Really? Yeah, I had no idea.
None of you can look at the date that's on your computer or over there, actually.
I couldn't. That's correct. Anyway, I'm joined by Harry and Charlie Downs, and today we're going to be talking about the unjust imprisonment of Lucy Connolly, Marco Rubio's strange glow-up, in which he's turned into one of the most based members of the Trump administration, which I think nobody's giving him enough credit for, so I really wanted to cover that today. It'll be fun. And five Marxist arguments against mass immigration that may surprise you. We're not being woke right about this, are we?
Never.
I've been accused, and I will sort of repudiate these accusations.
Yeah. Trying to learn from your enemies is the behavior of somebody...
Of a communist.
Of a communist, of a woke. Yeah.
Woke right, watch mojo right here. Which
is Top five Marxist arguments.
Right, okay, good idea for a show, though.
It is. Anyway, let's carry on.
All right. So, Lucy Connolly... bloody hell, I'm not getting this right already. Yeah. Lucy Connolly is now quite a famous case in England because she was arrested last year after the riots that were happening around the Southport murders for posting a tweet and given 31 months of prison time for it. And she has recently gone through an appeal for that prison time to see if she can get out early, and they said no. Currently, I believe that she has served about 280 something days in, so she's what, maybe a third?
Yeah.
A little bit less than a third into her overall sentence.
It's nearly 3 years she got.
Yes, and people are very upset about this whole fact because, well, the British government loves to punish people for tweets and things that they have said rather than things that people have actually done. Now, this is not to say anything to justify what it was that she posted originally, because what she posted originally was quite stupid. Am I allowed to
read it as reporting it? Yeah, of course.
She said on Twitter, this is on the day of the Southport killings back in July last year. Mass deportations now, set fire to all the effing hotels full of the bastards for all I care. While you're at it, take the treacherous government and politicians with them. I feel physically sick knowing that these families will now have to endure. If that makes me racist, then so be it. So clearly something said in the heat of the moment, something very stupid, because that is incitement to violence, and under our current speech codes that does warrant a punishment of some form. 31 months, though, especially given that she deleted it a few hours after because she evidently realised what a stupid thing that was to put out publicly. Yeah, she calmed down. 31 months is a bit harsh. Personally, if you're going to punish something like that for incitement to violence, I would say maybe a fine is where I would go with it, given that, as we'll find out, as I'll show you, there are paedophiles in this country who get suspended sentence and don't see a day of prison time, and she currently has spent almost a year in there.
And indeed politicians who assault their constituents, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
That's true. That was the Mike Amesbury case as well, wasn't it?
10 week suspended sentence.
Oh, the system works.
Yes, indeed.
The system working as intended, punishing people for what they say rather than what they do. So again, she was jailed at Birmingham Crown Court after pleading guilty. She was told she would have to serve 40% of her sentence in prison before being released on license. That's how the system works at the moment. So that means that she's more than halfway through the sentence that she'll have to serve in prison. At the very least, there's that. But giving a written judgment, the three Court of Appeal judges said that her principal ground of appeal was substantially based on a version of events put forward by the applicant, which we have rejected. Her husband also rejected calls from local MPs for his resignation from from West Northamptonshire Council, because he's a council member, I think a Tory council member. But he did lose his seat at this year's elections as Reform UK took control of the unitary authority. He said that Lucy posted one nasty tweet when she was very upset and angry about three little girls who were brutally murdered in Southport. She realised the tweet was wrong and deleted it within 4 hours.
Well, this is the point, I think, because I think anybody, you know, on that day, anyone could understand the way that she was feeling, right? Because I remember hearing about that news and just, you know, as everybody was, just being distraught, basically, because it was just such a hideous atrocity.
I remember a very sinking feeling in my stomach. It really hit hard, especially as a father myself.
Yeah, and those of us news. Those of us who do spend time online and have a, you know, an X account like Connolly does, you can see the temptation to tweet something angry and stupid in that moment. Now, it's not advisable to do that, but that's what she did. And you'd think that the English justice system would be able to make some kind of allowance for that. There'd be a kind of a human understanding, like, look, it was a stupid thing to say, and maybe you do deserve, you know, 2 week community service or a fine or something like that. Maybe I'm open to that argument, but actually it's the coldness and the kind of clinical way that she's been dealt with, where there's no understanding of that human element of this story, that I think is so troubling, especially in the context of other far more heinous crimes going effectively unpunished,
but other crimes that were being committed at the same time as this as well. This was just another one of those cases, like the way the police were hoovering up people who were standing around on the pavement near the protests, where the government
this guy shouted at the police.
The government wanted to set an example, and they wanted to let people know, if you dissent against us, this is how we're going to treat you.
I saw an interesting take as well on this, which is that Lucy Connolly can now be used as a statistic to cite, here's the threat of the far right, and, you know, here's an instance of far right crime that's, that someone's now in prison for.
But there is extra context as well, which this article puts forward, which is pretty harrowing. Basically, she has lost a child before. Her 19-month-old son passed away tragically because the NHS did not give him the care that he needed when he was very, very ill. They dismissed
kidney failure, I believe.
They dismissed his illness, sent her home, and then he died overnight. Harrowing thing to experience. And she herself is also a childminder. Yeah. So she's experienced this kind of thing before, has very close contact with children, obviously a very caring person. So this kind of news is going to affect somebody like this even harsher than it will affect many of the other people who are rightfully upset about the Southport murders. And following her deleting the initial tweet, later on in the week, she was tweeting out other things saying, like basically condemning rioting, where she said, FFS, I get that they're angry. I'm effing raging. However, this is playing right into their hands. I do not want civil unrest on our streets. Tommy Robinson is not going to say, but this is not going to get anyone anywhere. Protests, yes, but not riots. She also wrote at the end of that week, last night was not protesting, it was rioting. People are playing right into the hands of the establishment and the media. We need people to come together intelligently and articulately, not riots. And then to finish it off, she posted, I know people are angry, but violence is not the answer. So she clearly realized that she'd made a stupid mistake, backtracked it, and tried to give the appropriate message, which is, again, violence was not the answer in response to this. Mm. And she was right in saying that she was being, it was being played into the hands of the establishment. That didn't matter. None of that mattered. None of the extra context mattered. Stamped immediately with 31 months.
That would be excessive.
Yeah, it would be very excessive. She was charged under Section 19 of the Public Order Act and also stirring up racial hatred, etc. And she pled guilty for it, as so many did immediately following the arrests, because most people would have been funneled straight into the system and told your best bet is to plead guilty so that they'll reduce your sentence, because I believe that she got a bit of a reduced sentence for pleading guilty. Many of these people probably could have actually got much better sentences or got off if they'd pursued it, but you're in that situation, you're intimidated, you're scared. Most of these people are not criminals.
Yeah, they don't have any interaction with law enforcement or the judiciary. Yeah.
Outside of maybe walking past the police officer on
But the like no actual like in like knowledge of how the system works. Mm. Voice of Wales came on the other day and they gave us the example of this Welsh squaddy who just said, "I'm not pleading guilty," to because he had posted something not this inflammatory, admittedly, on Twitter or Facebook, and he was just like, "No, I'm not pleading guilty." And so he made them go through the courts properly, and he got off because what he had posted was just completely rational. And yeah, okay, don't get me wrong. In Lucy's case, that was more inflammatory, but I do agree that you know there's not only mitigating circumstances, but the fact that she deleted it very soon after and then was posting, "Don't riot, don't do
yes."
I mean,
there are all of these mitigating circumstances that probably could have gotten her a better sentence, or maybe no sentence, maybe community service or a fine, a best case scenario. But she was intimidated. Yeah. She had no idea how to navigate through the system. So, of course, she's get told by some guy, "This is the best you're going to get. Don't fight it." She's going to go with it.
It's very clear that the cold face of the state has been turned against the native British population.
Yeah, and I do think that the judicial system is one of those things where the complexity of the system is part of the, it's kind of part of a strategy.
Point.
Yeah, what do they say? It's the process is the punishment type kind of thing. Because somebody like Lucy Connolly, why would she have any knowledge of the intricacies of the British judicial system? You know, if she's told by a figure of authority, plead guilty and you get off, or you'll get a lighter sentence, why wouldn't she? And yet, you know, we've seen how that's turned out for her.
Yeah, it's purposefully labyrinthine and confusing so that if you as the normal law-abiding citizen gets thrown into it, then you have no idea how.
But the average law-abiding citizen has the underlying assumption that the state is basically on their side and that actually if I just follow the procedure because I was well-meaning and I pay my taxes and I obey the law and therefore I'm going to get dealt with fairly.
Yeah.
And we can see in the case of Lucy Connolly, no, the state had an intention with this. The intent, as Keir Starmer just came out and just completely flatly said, "We are going to punish you. You are going to jail. We are going to make sure you're an example that other people, when the next tragedy happens, will refer back to and say, yeah, okay, maybe I can't do anything because I'll just be oppressed, basically."
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly
that's what she got.
The system is not on your side because our independent courts, as they are known as, are completely captured because the judge who handed down this 31-month sentence literally gave her a little diversity is our strength speech as he declared the sentence. He said, "It is a strength of our society that it is both diverse and inclusive. There is always a very small minority of people who will seek an excuse to use violence and disorder causing injury, damage, loss and fear to wholly innocent members of the public, and sentences for those who incite racial hatred and disharmony in our society are intended to both punish and deter." So he literally gave the "diversity is our strength" speech.
That's what Orwell would call duck speak.
Yeah.
You know, just parroting along the state lines.
But interestingly, our judiciary is not independent. We aren't the United States. It's all part of the same institution, which is ultimately flowing from the Crown. Mm. So we don't have independent judges.
Starmer, in defending this, he said we do.
Did he?
Yeah. Rupert Lowe stood up in Parliament and said, "Does the Prime Minister agree that imprisoning Lucy Connolly, a young mother with a 12-year-old daughter, for one foolish social media post, soon deleted, is clearly not an efficient or fair use of prison?" Fair point to make, when also our prisons are almost entirely filled up.
Which is Starmer's point.
Yes, Keir Starmer said that sentencing was a matter for our courts and celebrated the independence of the judiciary.
They're not independent. I don't know how else to say it. They're literally not independent.
Well, according to who are you to question Keir Starmer?
Someone who knows how the British Constitution works better than him, apparently.
I think you'll find Keir Starmer was head
Director
of public
prosecutions, which is why this is all the more baffling that he would say that.
Well, but he does also say that he's strongly in favour of free speech.
Oh, yeah, that's
true. Yeah. But also,
as his revealed preference shows us.
Yeah. But also, again, Rupert Lowe himself has written to Justice Secretary Shabana Mahmood to demand Connolly's release, and even some Labour MPs have started to break ranks regarding this as well.
This is
Mary Glyndon, who has said that the 31-month prison sentence handed to her was unduly harsh and that she doesn't pose a threat to the public.
Okay, I don't mean to laugh.
Obviously, she doesn't.
I don't mean to laugh, but it's clownish that has to be said by an MP. But the thing is, this Labour MP, Mary here, doesn't understand the nature of what is happening, right? What is happening is the British public, the white British native majority, are being expressly told here, you will not complain about what happens to you. You will not complain about what happens to your country. And if you get out of line, outside of the very tightly prescribed boundaries, we're going to come down on you with all of the force of the state. Mm-hmm. All of it. And then we'll lie to your face and say this was independent and, you know, ideologically neutral and all these other sort of nonsense catchphrases they use. It's just not true. You are being oppressed by your own government. That's what this is.
It's the language of institutional democracy to make sure that you think that this is all just a nice, neutral, abstract system that runs by itself. Yeah. But on the whole point of no threat to the public, that this is unduly harsh, in response to all of this, the Telegraph put out this interesting article talking about the rapists, paedophiles, and terror offenders given shorter sentences than Lucy Connolly. So she got 31 months for a tweet. What examples do the Telegraph give of people who've done far worse?
Before we go on, let's just cast our minds back to shortly after Keir Starmer became Prime Minister, mm-hmm. where he decided to basically open the prisons. Mm-hmm. And within 24 hours, several of them had reoffended already.
Big surprise, right?
He let out actual criminals and murderers.
Yeah.
And it's so, okay, right. Why did you do that, Keir? Well, the prisons were overflowing and the Conservatives left us with a prison population that the prisons are about to fail any day now, was their line. And so, okay, what now? Well, Lucy Connolly has to go to jail. All of these Southport riders have to go to jail. Even though most of them actually didn't do very much. There's a handful of them who are trying to set fire to the...
to bins and hotels.
Yeah,
but
to the hotels. Yeah, okay. Those, you know, someone who threw a brick at the police. Okay, yeah, fine. But there were loads and loads of people who basically just posted things on social media or were shouting from the sidelines and just grabbed, arrested...
They needed to pump the numbers up so that the media could have a nice field day talking about how violent they were. Look at all these arrests that were made. People reading them will just get shocked by the sheer number.
24-hour courts going to process them. And it's like, right. So you just be aware the system is against you. That is just the thing to take from
this. I think, by the way, that there are plans to release more prisoners, this time offenders and domestic abusers. Oh. That would be nice to have those people out.
I think part of the reason for the chemical castration is that they are thinking of releasing these people. And apparently, it reduces recidivism on sex offenders by 60%.
Is that it?
I was going to say, I would have thought it would be more as well. Yeah. But I think it's basic. I think what they mean by chemical castration is that they pump them full of hormones to reduce their sex drive.
Yeah. Right, but it's not permanent, though, right?
No, I don't believe so.
That's interesting.
But I enjoy...
If you want to prevent rapists and murderers from repeat offending, I have a much more permanent solution. But that's not been allowed in England for a while.
That was banned in 1964, unfortunately.
I am sort of enjoying the kind of the schizophrenia. I mean, enjoying is probably the wrong word to use, but like the schizophrenia of this Labour government is just like amusing to watch from afar, because on the one hand it's all, you know, the diversity is our strength stuff we're hearing, and then on the other it's chemically castrating sex offenders and putting prisoners to work, filling potholes.
Let's break down the demographics on that.
Yeah,
is that a racist policy here? Because I think it might turn out to be.
Yeah,
but also the hardline anti-immigrant deport them all rhetoric.
We're coming for you.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, yeah, we're coming for you. We're going to deport you or castrate you. It's like, Jesus Christ. Yeah. And the thing is,
they're trying to play for the Daily Mail readers.
100%, but it's absolutely not working. That's the thing. Like, Keir Starmer's never been lower in the polls. And they did a YouGov poll that broke down by party affiliation or intentional voting. And 50% of Reform voters polled realised that Keir Starmer was trying to win them over, but only 4% were like, yeah, I might consider it. Mm. So it's, like, it's not working. People know what you're doing.
Yeah. Well, I think people can hear the words. They can see you saying the words. But it's whether they believe you're actually going to follow through.
Well, this raises the question of whether Starmer's actually going to last until 29. And I don't buy necessarily that he will, because I think that, as mad as this might sound, I think you could sell Angela Rayner saying these things to the general public more effectively than you can, you know, North London human rights lawyer Keir Starmer. She's got a little bit of that common touch about her, as much as people don't like her.
She's not a detestable person like Keir Starmer is.
Exactly. And I saw a story yesterday that said that she's positioning herself in that kind of way. So
I mean, I don't think she's our best and brightest or anything, but like, you know.
Well, the problem with that is, alternatively, I can take Keir Starmer seriously.
Sure, yeah.
I cannot take Angela Rayner seriously. Mm. On a pure aesthetic level, Angela Rayner is clearly a council estate...
Don't say it.
I want to say it, but I won't say it.
Yeah.
Keir Starmer whatever you want to say about the man's morals or history, I've said plenty.
Yep.
He is a serious individual who has a track record behind him of getting things done.
Terrible things,
yes.
Yeah.
But he's got things done. And the British ship of state needs somebody in charge who gets things done.
Mm.
He's a Blairite for a reason. He has that behind him for a reason. But anyway, back onto this. So here's just some of the examples of people who got better sentences than Lucy Connolly. So Hugh Edwards, everybody's favourite disgraced BBC presenter.
Paedophile.
I mean, need you say?
Yeah, well, yeah
BBC
good point.
Presenter.
Yeah, tautological, isn't it?
So he had indecent pictures of children, quite a lot of them, some of them very young, suspended 6-month sentence. Jack Davies got the images, I believe, off of the same person that Hugh Edwards got his images off of, and also had Class A drugs on him at the same time. Suspended 12-month sentence.
Is this guy another BBC presenter?
No.
I can't tell.
But he did argue that he should get the same treatment as a BBC presenter.
Of course
he and I were the same, you see.
Yeah, well, they are.
Yeah. Child rapist.
Oh.
Suspended 2-year sentence.
Why? Well, I mean, why do I ask? Why do I ask?
Yeah, and then he breached the terms of his sentence by flying to Egypt without notifying officers. And then he avoided jail again. Judge said, the only reason you have escaped immediate custody is because of the prison overcrowding crisis.
Is Lucy Connolly in his place or something?
I would only assume so, because look, he was convicted in August of 2024, the month of all of the mass arrests.
Yeah.
So presumably they needed, the prisons were in more need of putting Lucy Connolly behind bars.
As
than,
was yelling racist slurs at the police, and, so you're going to have to go free.
Well, unironically, rapist. She is a greater threat to them than a child
well,
rapist
is. Yeah, I suppose. Yeah. Domestic abuser, suspended 21-month sentence, and 10-year restraining order, but...
Okay.
Doctor with child abuse images, Mansoor Khan, suspended sentence.
8 months. Only 8 months.
Another rapist with a suspended sentence. Big surprise, eh?
Oh, that but was
he
in
got
Swindon.
He got Swindon rapist walks free, but he got 43 days in a sex offending program.
Nikhil and, Chopra
and ordered to pay £187.
Oh wow!
So finally, the state has been reimbursed for your rape. Thank you very much, sir. And. And this man, Charles Cannon, who actually was, by the looks of it, planning on performing some domestic terrorism.
Oh, really?
Collected documents on how to make homemade explosives and weapons and did a lot of Fed posting. Yeah. A lot of Fed posting. Also suspended sentence. So this guy...
Why would this guy get a suspended sentence from Connolly? Because he's a right-wing terrorist.
Yeah, by the looks of it. Certainly so, but apparently gets a suspended sentence despite the fact that, Lucy Connolly fed posted, but it's not like she actually had plans on how to burn the hotel down.
Yeah.
That is wild.
Mm. Sometimes it just seems like it might just be, well, obviously with Lucy Connolly, it was the environment, given the situation, and it might just be luck of the draw with the judge as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because they're also independent. But one of the other interesting things I just want to end on regarding this is just to clear up that whatever you may think of Lucy Connolly, she's definitely not an actual racist. She just seems like a bit of a normie. She might be a Tommy Robinson fan, like centre-right normie type, because there's now reports come out since her appeal was denied, which have upset some people, that she helped a Nigerian family become British citizens by sponsoring them. Dr. Henny Enyi said the childminder had gone out of her way to help with her family's application for British citizenship, even providing character references, and this is also tied to the fact that part of the news media is now going with the ones that support her, saying that a lot of the children that she cares for as part of her childminding job are of African and Asian heritage. So
at least she was sponsoring a doctor.
I suppose there was that. But I do find it interesting that she's just a very, very normie person who probably is just against mass migration. She even sponsors these people. But because of how horrific the situation was last year, it just tipped her over the edge into Fed posting.
It's crazy how unjust this is.
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy.
And this is just how the British state works. We also have that old Middle East Eye article showing us that the next time that this will happen, they will do the same things over and over and over again. Anything to manage the perception, the media response to a crisis, rather than actually actually handling the origin of the crisis, solving the problem in the first place. They don't want to do that, so this is the system working.
Brain Biscuit says, to my American eyes, the lesson of persecution of Connolly is that the British government has the position that its citizens are not allowed to be angry about murders of particular groups of people. It's more by particular groups of people, yeah, actually.
You're allowed to be angry about George Floyd happening, yeah, all the way across the Atlantic, yeah, Ocean.
As long as an American cop has killed a black man in America, go and protest and burn things down as much as you like, apparently. But anyway, yeah.
That's not our advice, by the way.
Yeah, no, that's our assessment of what the British state thinks. And a drunk changeling says, the police put another weight on the pressure cooker and congratulate themselves on the job well done. Yeah, but the thing is, you've got to remember that the police are hardly our best and brightest. So, you know, what are you going to do? Anyway, so let's. I thought we were talking about something a little more cheery, which is Marco Rubio. Because Marco Rubio has revealed himself to be something of a dark horse. Mm. And nobody really saw this coming because Marco Rubio, as far as I was aware, was just some rhino.
Yeah.
Who was just some normie Republican, you know, I agree with the left on basically everything.
A conic kind of character.
Yeah, just very normal.
Yeah.
I've never paid much attention to him, frankly.
I hadn't paid that much attention to him because everything I'd seen was him just the cookie-cutter Republican, safe, you know, like, narrative.
Yeah. Obviously, sort of American commenters have a lot more knowledge of him, but
sure,
looking from across the ocean, there were always much more interesting and notable American, yeah, 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 politicians Marco to Rubio, take note of.
He just seemed very bland, mm, and very uninteresting. And so, I mean, you may remember that back in 2015 when Trump said, you know what, I'm going to do it, and everyone freaked out about it. I mean, after Trump was like, you know, Mexico sending us people who have a lot of problems, they're bringing those problems to us, they're bringing drugs, bringing crime, they're rapists. And Marco Rubio said, quote, Trump's comments are not just offensive and inaccurate, but also divisive. So on the normie Republican narrative with that back then.
And they were enemies at the time. Yeah, so of course he's going to...
Well, I'll go through it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So, I mean, like, that wasn't the only thing. He called Donald Trump a con artist, called him embarrassing, called him the most vulgar person to ever aspire to the presidency. And it was Marco Rubio who coined the small hands thing, I think, as well. But yeah, like, yeah, con man, blah, blah, blah. We can't let him take over the Reagan and conservative movement. And so it's like, right, okay, that was pretty normie. Like, pretty mainstream, center-right Republican talking points. Boring, really uninspiring. And so it was nice when Donald Trump smacked him down, obviously. Marco Rubio is a total lightweight who I wouldn't hire to run one of my smaller companies. A highly overrated politician was one thing. He called him sweaty. Called him a puppet. Called him a nasty guy, although for some reason Facebook won't let us see that. But and, of course, calls him Little Marco. And so this, this was a strange thing, how Little Marco then became kind of one of Trump's closest friends and best buddies, which was interesting. So basically, Marco had been ingratiating himself into the Trump circle after Trump won the nomination and, after he, declared for 2024, and Trump passed over him for J.D. Vance. And so instead of acting like a salty bitch, Rubio was like, okay, well, I'm just going to work harder. I'm going to double down and I'm going to get the job done. And so he and Trump actually started working amicably on shared policy goals. Mm. And Trump realized, okay, he took the sort of, you know, the public ribbing quite well, gave as good as he got. And okay, so Marco Rubio basically starts getting a bunch of big jobs. He's now the top diplomat, foreign aid chief, national archivist, and national security advisor. Mm. And so he's doing a lot for Trump. And
it just shows you Trump's magnanimity, doesn't it?
It does, doesn't it?
Yeah.
The fact that if you can take it on the chin, Trump will respect
it. He likes
it. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, the king approves.
Exactly. And so Marco Rubio has been absolutely scrapping with Democrats. And I won't play this one because it's about 4 minutes long and goes on. But I'm going to play a bunch of clips that are just, okay, I didn't realize you had this in you, Marco, and I'm loving it. So you've got this first one about USAID, where Marco Rubio is just like, no, everything that Elon Musk did with USAID is good, and we need to do more.
And I have to tell you directly and personally that I regret
it. Turn that up a bit,
Secretary of State.
Jack, sorry.
I yield back.
May I respond?
You may sit.
Well, first of all, I think it went down in volume for me.
Yeah, that went the wrong way, I think. But yeah, no. So as you can see here, quote, "I'm very proud of what we've done with USAID. I don't regret cutting $10 million for male circumcisions in Mozambique." Yeah, good. Why would you be doing that? "We spent $227,000 for Big Cat's YouTube channel from USAID. We spent $40 million from Social Cohesion in Mali." Whatever the hell that means. So I can go on and on. I got the list here and there's more. I didn't even bring the whole list. "I don't know how this makes us stronger and more prosperous as a nation." Well, I can't explain how male circumcisions in Mozambique make America stronger, I have to admit.
Something to do with inclusivity and diversity.
I don't know. Democracy, surely?
So in like an RPG sense, like diversity, inclusivity is always like a plus 10% buff to strength. Mm. That's how they seem to treat it. So if you're doing that and it's more diverse, then you're buffing your strength somehow.
I guess you must be. Yeah. And then
let's not forget, during COVID as well, the British government was doing very similar things to funding the YouTube channels. Remember, I think it was Philosophy Tube and a number of the Bread Tube lefty channels were getting government funding from the British government to spread COVID propaganda.
Yeah, I would have done it. It's, you know, how much care?
You're always looking for that big sellout paycheck that never comes, aren't you?
I know. You know, I'm constantly being told we're being funded by Israel, but I'm like, but I've never received a check.
I would have more bedrooms than I do if we were being funded by Israel.
Right, but then you've got Marco Rubio on foreign aid, which is, again, just highly strong.
"Yes, we canceled a bunch of contracts in USAID. Some were stupid and outrageous. Others didn't serve the national interest. And others we kept. And we are folding it under the Department of State. And you know why? Because we want it to be part of the toolbox of foreign policy, not a standalone. It is not charity. Foreign aid is not charity. It is designed to further the national interest of the United States."
Totally solid.
Yeah. It's amazing the way that Trump is like terraforming the Republican Party.
Oh, it's so
good. People like Rubio, who, as you said, were just rhinos before, conservatives, who are now basically, I mean, they sound like him. They sound like Trump.
Yeah.
It's great. Just
hardline nativists at this point. And it gets better, frankly. So Rubio going on about immigration and just being like, no. Look, you understand. It's our immigration policy, not yours.
"Our immigration policy should be based on the national interest of the United States, period. End of story. If there is a subset of people that are easier to vet, who we have a better understanding of who they are and what they're going to do when they come here, they're going to receive preference, no doubt about it. There are a lot of sad stories around the world, millions and millions of people around the world. It's heartbreaking. We cannot assume millions and millions of people around the world. No country can. So you have to have a process of deciding who do you prioritize, who do you allow in. We do it all the time. We do it in our immigration system now under our current laws. Unfortunately, it's primarily based on family connection and not on what they're going to contribute to the society from a merit standpoint. That should be changed, but that'll require statutory changes. But the bottom line is, this notion that somehow we have to accept anyone who wants to come to the United States is absurd. No country in the world has an immigration policy like that."
Well, we do.
Yeah, that's right.
But again, look, notice that what he's doing there is explicitly carving out, if a group is easier to vet, such as, say, I don't know, South African refugees, then we're going to take them much more easily than just randos from around the world who are just clamoring to get in.
I love that he keeps using that phrase, national interest, as well.
Yeah.
You know, because that's such a, you know, you think that's such a sort of politician-y type phrase, but it's not one you hear our leaders use.
No.
You never hear Keir Starmer talk about Britain's national interest. You know, Chagos, mass immigration,
on an international scale, there is such a thing as a national interest.
Yeah.
When we had the Empire, we had national interests that we were spreading internationally.
Yes.
So it is a completely legitimate political term to use. Like you say, we just don't use it anymore because our national interests are giving away our things to the global south.
But I love that he's talking about every apparatus of the state as being a tool to further the national interest, whether that's foreign aid or immigration, which is obviously the correct way to look at it. But again, our leaders don't look at it like that.
No, and it's been many years since I've heard someone speaking so clearly and forthrightly about what the purpose of government is, which is to advance the national interest, using the tools at their disposal for the advantage of the American people and not, I don't know, the international doctrine of human rights or whatever. Yeah.
It's interesting to pair this up with the South African government's announcement regarding the Boer refugees going to America. Because one of the things that they put in there that was interesting, that people mainly highlighted the fact that they were saying, oh, we're not punishing them, we're making them pay for historic injustice. But one of the other things that they said that was very interesting was that they said that this is promoting right-wing ideas, and this goes against the letter and spirit of international law. So,
oh, really? That's an interesting mask-off moment.
That was very interesting, because basically what it says is that, and I think this is absolutely true, since 1948 and the UN being established, international law has basically been a resource extraction mechanism from Western nations to the Third World.
I mean, that's literally what Keir Starmer is giving away the Chagos Islands for. Mm-hmm. It's just social justice.
So this kind of thing where you're reframing national interest to be actually national interest, and instead of let's just give away our stuff to crying non-white people, that does go against the international order.
And by the way, you know, I had a recent experience where I raised the idea of national interest on LBC, as you may know, and it, you know, every single other person in the room, from the SNP communist to the Tory, was saying, "How dare you speak in the language of?" Yeah, they didn't literally say, but they were effectively saying, "How dare you speak in the language of national interest?" And I quite
the language of mustache men.
Yeah, well, indeed.
It's not though, is it? Like, it's the language of every normal state prior to 1948.
Yeah, but that's for you just being somehow, you know, outside the realms of acceptable discourse. Yeah. It's mad.
We're liberal global internationalists, says Ian Dale. Yeah. Conservative.
And that says it all, doesn't it?
But that's the thing, you know, SNP communist radical Ian Dale conservative are like, "How could you, sir?"
Yeah.
And it, remarkable. But anyway,
why it's so gratifying to see the literal American government speaking in these terms.
Exactly. Not just Trump, but also, you know, Trump's agents in every place. It's like, no, this is the way it's going to be.
Yeah.
And this is another great one, right? Because as you can see here, he's being interrogated by a lady saying, "You revoked a foreign woman's student visa." And Marco Rubio's like, "Yeah, we did. And we're going to do more."
A student was a guest in the United States on a student visa. No one's entitled to a student visa.
So you revoked her student visa based on an op-ed, which trumps the supreme law of the land, which is the Constitution.
Someone's coming up here to stir up problems on our campus. We're going to revoke their visa.
She didn't do any of that.
Sorry. Okay. Don't worry. But the point is, The point is, in this woman is horrifically outraged. "Oh, how could you?" And Rubio just goes into it and he's just like, "Listen, can we get this right?" Yeah. He's just like, "Listen, she was over here on a student visa in order to study. And instead she decided she was going to join a radical left-wing organization and start protesting and causing trouble. And so, we're going to revoke student visas for people who come here and cause trouble. And we're going to do more. Yeah. We're going to keep doing
this." It's not your human right to be in the United States.
And that's literally what he says. Yeah. "You have no constitutional right to a visa."
There we go. Yeah.
Exactly correct. No, go away. It's completely within the jurisdiction of the Trump administration to say, "No, not that person. Sorry, get out." And then you've got more like this. Well, this is a long one, so I won't play it. But basically, he reiterates, again, the point. "You are a guest in our country." Mm-hmm. And in fact, he says, "If you invite me into your home and I start putting mud on your couch and spray painting your kitchen, I bet you're going to kick me out. We're going to do the same thing if you come to the US as a visitor and create a ruckus for us. I encourage every country to do that." It's like, yes, why not? What is the argument against this? Sorry, you can't kick them out for causing trouble and, like, you know, burning down campuses, whatever it is they're doing. It's like, yeah, no, we can.
Whereas once again, compare it to our situation, our leaders, when they are confronted with a situation where a guest is putting mud on the couch and spray painting the kitchen, will get out the fine china and say, "Do you want to throw these at the wall?"
Yeah, exactly. It's crazy.
Yeah.
So anyway, Rubio not having any of it, and he keeps going. And so you've got this one. Hopefully we can hear this one. This is really good.
"In the case of El Salvador, absolutely.
I cannot hear this.
Absolutely. One. We deported gang members."
So basically,
gang members,
feel
including
the vibrations
the one you had a margarita
of it through
with.
The wall.
And that guy is a human trafficker.
Basically, in this one, he's saying that, look, the judicial branch can just shut its goddamn mouth, right? Because, of course, the Trump administration is like, look, we're going to deport a bunch of gang members who are here illegally, and the courts have been trying to intercede in this. And Rubio is just here going, no, listen, the courts don't get to decide our foreign policy or domestic policy when it comes to illegal immigrants. They just don't get to decide this. And you can see he's just not taking their shit.
Yeah.
He's just like, no, this is how it's going to be because we're the ones who got elected and you aren't.
Yeah. About time.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely about time. Yeah. There's another one where the Pope came out and was like, well, is it Catholic to deport illegal immigrants? And, aren't you going to be compassionate? And Rubio's just like, listen, you're not a political figure. You're a spiritual figure, and there's nothing compassionate about illegal immigrants. Now, Marco Rubio is a Floridian Cuban, so I'm guessing he's Catholic. So to come out and be like, yeah, I actually don't care about what the Pope says about this.
You could ask the Spanish during the Reconquista as well.
Well,
was it very Catholic of them?
Well, I mean, to be fair, considering what they were up against, maybe. The Aztecs were pretty awful, and they were pagans. So
I was more talking about the Reconquista of the Iberian Peninsula.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course. Well, yeah, I mean, I would say so, but yeah. I'm not a Catholic, am I? But the point being is that Rubio has been completely strong on all of these points, and he's making moral arguments against their attempt to moral shame. Rather than being just a standard conservative who goes, oh, good point, I literally have no principles or moral arguments.
Well, it's just wild, because I'm a Catholic, right? And it's just wild to me that he's being presented with this argument that somehow just being nice in a really vague way is somehow good Christian, literally, right? And yet, well, actually, you know, a lot of Christianity, you're sure there's the mercy side of Christianity is what people think of, but actually there's a pretty substantial justice side of Christianity as well.
People don't understand that what Jesus was actually preaching was a form of social justice circa about 2016.
You're so right.
It just took us a few years to catch up.
So
he's just going on. And I think that the best one was this one, which I'm not going to try playing because I'll just be disappointed. But he's arguing with Senator Tim Kaine, so, you know, Democrat grandee, about the South African refugees coming. And Tim Kaine is trying to accuse him of being a racist. And Marco Rubio is just not having any of it. And so he says, you know, are you saying that you've got a different standard based upon the color of somebody's skin? And Rubio says, I'm not the one arguing that. Apparently you are, because you don't like the fact that they are white. And I mean, that's the bombshell.
And it's so refreshing to hear a conservative figure not going, oh, I promise I'm not racist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He wasn't like, oh, no, I'm not racist. He's like, no, you just hate the fact that they're white.
Yeah.
And Tim Kaine's got nothing in response to this, because he does hate the fact they're white.
And that is a good reframing of it as well, because, obviously you have double standards.
Yeah. I don't take lectures from people who just hate people because they're white, because these people are in genuine danger of being murdered in a horrific way.
Yeah.
Through racial grievance. So, yeah, we're taking them in because it seems to be the moral thing to do. And it's just, again, I didn't realize Rubio would have it in him, of all people. So, superb. And there was this one that was, again, just absolutely brilliant, just not taking that S. Right, as Senator Chris here is like, look, I voted for you and I regret voting for you to be Secretary of State. And Rubio's like, you regretting voting for me confirms I'm doing a good job. Completely unapologetic about all of this. And so, absolutely superb. Absolutely superb. I just wanted to give Rubio head pats for all of this.
I just want to say, this chap is he used to be the chair of the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee, so he's a big Democrat, and if he's saying that he regrets voting for Rubio, then yeah, it's a pretty good sign.
But no, my enemies hate me.
Yeah. But that's the thing, right? He didn't think Rubio was his enemy.
No.
Right.
Interesting.
I, a Democrat, I'm going to vote for you because I think you're a puppet.
One of us.
Yeah, a little controllable, you know, uniparty Republican. And Rubio has actually come swinging out of the gates, being like, listen, all you white-hating freaks, get out of my country. And they're like, I regret voting for you. It's like, good, that means I'm doing something right.
Do you know what this makes me wonder as well? Is just about, you know, conservatives in general in this country, for example, is how many of them are waiting for a Trump figure to emerge so that they can do a Rubio and come out the gates and start saying this sort of thing.
I've been told by people who know who have a lot of contacts on the inside that the Tory and Reform establishment is absolutely filled with people who think that they are the based one on the inside.
So yeah, totally, totally. Yeah,
There is an appetite for it. They're
somehow
just,
they're never the MPs, though.
Yeah, they're just not the MPs, and they're not the ones in the position of power.
Yeah, although there are Conservative MPs that I think it looks like they're sort of, in a way, breaking ranks. Like Katie Lamb is one who comes to mind, who's been incredibly strong on all of this sort of stuff recently. But
it is something that I wonder, but the thing is, then I wonder, well, how is it that you can just sit there quietly and allow them to constantly trash your party, trash everything about the country, and be like, okay, maybe I'll do it tomorrow? I mean, like,
it's just a question of back.
Yeah, the time was yesterday, or now, or just immediately.
I suppose what happened with Rupert Lowe was a nice wider message to spread to all the rest of them as well, which is that if you push a little bit too hard, we'll get the police involved.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get you arrested over trumped-up charges.
Yeah, but the thing is, like, we just need some people who are just going to come out and be unapologetic. She's like, yeah, no, if you're not happy, that means I'm happy and I'm doing a good job.
Yeah.
Anyway, so Neo-Unrealist says, Rubio started out as one of the first Tea Party people elected. He softened when he got into the Senate, but since 2016, he came out as one of Trump's Florida mafia insiders, often seated behind Trump, beside Trump. Yeah, I know, it's been great. And the engaged few says, look, I don't care what caused Rubio's transformation from mincing metrosexual fop to Secretary Slapaho, populist foreign policy firebrand. I'm just glad it happened. Yeah, me too. And I like to say, a lot of people are just not really paying attention to just how much he's coming out and just slugging them metaphorically in the face, and I wanted to.
Yes.
Anyway, let's move on.
Can I grab the...
you can.
Yeah, that's the one.
That is interesting. I didn't know that he was a Tea Party guy to begin with, though. So it seems like he let himself get swept up by the Washington establishment for time there, and then Trump has just fundamentally changed what Washington establishment is.
Mm. Yeah.
So... Last time I was on the show, I discussed the emergence of the post-woke left, and I'd like to continue in that vein because I think there's a lot more to say. I specifically would like to talk about how the post-woke left, some of the figures that I discussed last time, are approaching the topic of immigration, right, which is the most pressing issue of our time in Britain. It's by far the most important issue to the majority of the public, as dozens, well, I don't know about dozens, but many polls show it's hugely important. It has been for a long time because the British public has been so poorly served by their leaders.
Even on lefty polls like YouGov, which are sort of self-selecting left-biased polls.
Yes, indeed.
Still the most important issue.
Yes, so before we begin, in that sort of vein, I'd like to promote this event, which I am running alongside Eric Kaufman, titled Is Woke Dead? With Matt Goodwin, Gad Saad, and Batya Ungar-Sargon. If you want to go and you are a Lotus Eaters viewer, you can use the code LOTUS25 for 25% off tickets. So there should be a link down below to that if you're interested in coming. So... let's begin. I want to present five Marxist arguments against mass immigration, okay? Because I think that it's important that we learn from our enemies. It's important that we take what we can from their ideas. And I think using their language against them, I've done this myself, it caused them to just sort of short circuit. They don't know how to come back against it. When you reveal them to be actually agents of the establishment and not the radicals that they like to imagine themselves as. So I want to begin with a letter that Karl Marx himself wrote to two of his collaborators in the United States, Siegfried Meyer and August Vocht, in 1870, in which he speaks of the impact of Irish immigration to England. So he says that owing to the constantly increasing concentration of leaseholds, Ireland constantly sends her own surplus to the English labour market, and thus forces down wages and lowers the material and moral position of the English working class. And most importantly of all, every industrial and commercial centre in England now possesses a working class divided into two hostile camps, English proletarians and Irish proletarians. The ordinary English worker hates the Irish worker as a competitor who lowers his standard of life, and in relation to the Irish worker, he regards himself as a member of the ruling nation, and consequently he becomes a tool of the English aristocrats and capitalists against Ireland, thus strengthening their domination over himself. This antagonism is artificially kept alive and intensified by the press, the pulpit, the comic papers, in short, by all the means at the disposal of the ruling classes. This antagonism is the secret of the impotence of the English working class, despite its organisation. It is the secret by which the capitalist class maintains its power, and the latter is quite aware of this. So there's quite a bit to unpack there.
Making good points, though.
Yeah, but there's some real truth in there. I mean, obviously, it's all couched in the language of, you know, the English working class have a false conscience and they need to kind of break out of it. But actually, a lot of what he says there is totally spot on and very applicable today. So the first argument we're going to look at is the fact that mass immigration is a weapon of capital against labour. So in 2017, here as reported by Politico, the business group London First was lobbying the government in the aftermath of Brexit for an increasingly liberal immigration policies after leaving the European Union.
Makes sense why they're called London First.
Well, I was going to say that. I think it's quite, you know, the fact they're called London First is just quite revealing, isn't it?
You see why Boris is
Yeah, so London First is now called Business London, and we can see some of their members here. So we've got various sort of property groups, real estate groups, financial services organisations, and then huge companies like Deloitte and Uber.
Of course, Uber's on there, right?
Yeah, London Gatwick Airport and all the rest of it. You know, these are not like communist organizations. This is capital, right? This is the capitalist
international
class.
Capital.
Grosvenor.
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And these were the people in 2017 lobbying for an increased, sort of a more liberal immigration system. We also have the boss.
Just as a stop on that, because I've had these arguments with leftists on Twitter so many times. Like, it's not the immigrants, it's the business owners. And it's like, there is really no distinction between those two, because who do you think the business owners are using against the natives, you fool?
Yes, exactly, exactly. And this is the point, and this is really what I'm going to be driving at here, is that the idea that mass immigration is some kind of Marxist plot is just, I think it's just nonsensical. It's, you know, the language of progressivism and kind of liberalism is used to sell it to the masses as it being a kind of compassionate thing that people should embrace. But actually, the people who are really benefiting at the end of the day are people like this chap, the boss of Next, who in 2022 was urging the government to let more foreign workers in to ease labour shortages. Now, at the time, I mean, he was another Brexiteer. He's a conservative peer, and yet he's one of the foremost architects of the current immigration system that we have. Because at the time when he was saying this, net migration was sitting at about 239,000 a year. It's like, oh, imagine it. And that's still mad.
And of course, he was a Tory peer.
I hate the phrase labour shortages as well, because there's no shortage of labour. We've never had more population in this country.
Yeah.
Ever before.
Yeah. Cheap labor shortages, perhaps, as well.
Yeah, yeah. That's exactly. You know, who was it the other day who was complaining that 25? Oh, it was Fraser Nelson. It was like 25% of Birmingham is on benefits. So yeah, there's no labor shortage. Yeah. It's just we are incentivizing people not to work.
Yes. Yes. Exactly. So obviously, you know, it was revealed yesterday that gross migration is now 1 million, with net being 500,000. So I hope Lord Wolfson is happy with
and just
where we're at
just
now.
To be clear, like I covered this yesterday, like the if you look at the graph, gross migration of 1 million is unprecedented prior to the Boris wave.
Yeah. Right?
If you take the Boris wave out of this, a net migration of nearly 500,000 is record-breaking migration into this country.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it's just the Boris wave makes that look less damaging, but that's still insane.
Well, I think that they are relying on the public having a short memory on this topic, but I don't think they do. Because you can see it around you.
Yeah, you look at the high streets.
Yeah. So just to drive home this point then, that mass immigration is a weapon of capital against labour, it's very easily shown that mass immigration suppresses wages by, you know, supply and demand. You inflate the workforce, and especially when you introduce people from regions of the world that are impoverished, like, for example, India and Nigeria, who are the two most common non-EU nationalities to come in the last 5 years. You know, India, for example, the average salary, yearly salary, is £3,500, okay? And so why wouldn't those people come here when the economic prospects are so much better?
There's also, they're not only willing to work for less money, they're willing to work in worse conditions for longer hours as well. What you're actually opening up is your domestic labour force to competition with international slave labour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And you can't compete with international slave labour.
Just a quick thing on this as well. It's not like leftists haven't historically made this argument either.
Of course, yeah.
Jeremy Corbyn was making this argument 30 years ago.
Yes.
Until he became... There's something about being a woke liberal globalist that they use the language of Marxism to go full universal globalism, and the Marxists are completely hamstrung by it, because you've got people like Peter Kropotkin in The Conquest of Bread, who points out, look, the wealth of the capitalist comes from the poverty of the laborer, because if he wasn't impoverished, he wouldn't work in these slave conditions for the international capitalist.
Yes.
And so you must, you know, any kind of immigration argument, it's if you're looking at your own population saying, right, they're actually not poor enough to work in this kind of deep, you know, embarrassingly subsistence position.
Yeah, yeah.
We will just import people who know nothing else as competition for them. You can't possibly say that that's in any way good for the country or good for the people. There's just no argument for it.
And George Galloway, for example, still says this kind of thing. Despite the alliances that he makes, he does still believe this, which is, you know, and it's because he is actually a more orthodox kind of leftist.
Yeah, basically. He's a sort of classic leftist.
Yeah, yeah. And so this is shown by the fact, obviously there are other factors at play, but since 2008, the average wages have just not kept pace with inflation, not kept pace with GDP growth as well. GDP has gone up, but GDP per capita has essentially flatlined since then. And all of this is because, you know, all of this leads to the fact that most migrants who come here are actually imposing a net cost on ordinary people, on taxpayers. But hey, thank goodness, Next are getting cheap labour, right?
Yeah, and the Deliveroo economy is just like, you know, what are they paying into the thing?
Nothing. There is also an interesting argument to be made regarding the birth rates as well, because birth rates are one of the ways in which they like to continually justify, well, if we don't have the birth rates, then we're going to find another way of replacing the population that's already here, so we need to bring people in. There has been more recent recent research done suggesting that a greater diversity of ethnic groups within the population suppresses the birth rates. So they're creating the problem or making the problem worse with the solution. Again, it's poison for the cure.
And this brings us to the next point, which is that mass immigration makes class consciousness impossible. Because this idea that some, you know, like a 23-year-old Eritrean Deliveroo driver is going to have some kind of brotherhood or kinship with a 56-year-old builder is just absurd. You know, it's a crazy idea.
I've covered this. The Amazon have studied it within their own warehouses. They have a unionization metric by which they score different factors that lead to their staff unionizing in the warehouse and factories. And diversity reduces the chances of unionization drastically.
Oh, really? Well, so as a hyper-capitalist, I need to get some different hosts.
Yes, very good.
Just a quick thing on this as well. This is something that has, again, been known by the communists for a long time. Because you remember that the end of the Communist Manifesto is the working men have no country. Mm-hmm. They've already been stolen from by the capitalists. So working men of all countries unite. Well, come World War One. The fear of Bolshevism, no, it turns out that people are actually a lot more attached to their own countries than there are their own class anyway.
Totally. Yeah.
And then if you disintegrate the class itself, well, then what have they got?
And this is the point. In order to have class consciousness, you know, the precondition to that is a shared trust, a shared identity. Mm. This idea of the kind of international working class is just nonsensical. Well,
on that point, recently I read a very interesting book called Russia Under the Bolshevik Revolution, by Richard Pipes. And he's talking in the chapter about the attempts to export communism in the immediate aftermath of the Russian Civil War. And he talks about how they were setting off to war against Poland, because there was that short war there where they were trying to take over. And the Russians, Lenin, was just expecting that the Polish proletariat would be so eager to join up with the Red Army and usurp their own government. It turns out, in the aftermath of the Treaty of Versailles finally getting some kind of sovereign independence as their own nation, the Polish proletariat was a lot more attracted to their own nationalism than they were to being part of the international proletariat.
Yes.
So the Russians completely fell flat on their faces.
And it's in every case that this has happened. Like, there's never been international working class solidarity.
The Hungarians ended up fighting back against it. That's what led to the rise of Mussolini, was fighting back against the Russian the red communist years from, I think it was 1920 to 22. All of those big evil movements in the early 20th interwar period, that was basically saying, no, we don't want Bolshevism.
Yeah, it's all a response to communism.
Yes.
Fascism, and so, every case a response to communism.
And so this low social trust that we are experiencing in our country because of mass immigration is making class...
strangers.
But it's making class consciousness impossible, because 50% said that they feel disengaged from society in general. I mean, how do you have class consciousness or solidarity with people who don't speak your language, whose culture you don't recognize, etc.?
And moreover, we get a really good example of this in Swindon, but it's the same everywhere, really, because the thing about the Boris Wave is they're not from any one particular place.
Yeah, right? They're from everywhere.
And so they can't even understand each other.
Yes.
And so there's no solidarity between them. They don't care about each other. They do. Yeah. Again, they look at each other with suspicion as they pass in the street.
Which is in the interests of the capitalist class, because it keeps the working class divided.
Exactly. So the capitalist has essentially like the whip hand in this. They say, well, I'll offer you a job. And what else are you going to do? You haven't got a social network to respond to fall back on. You know, it's either that or begging the government for money.
So. Totally. And that's to say nothing of the crime brought by mass immigration, which is also a factor in degrading social trust and making class consciousness impossible. The third argument from a Marxist perspective against mass immigration is that it is neo-colonial exploitation. So
that's totally true.
Yeah. So between between Q4 2020 and Q3 2023, the UK awarded 108,000 entry visas to healthcare professionals from countries that are described by the WHO as having the world's most fragile health systems. Okay, so these are countries that are teetering on the brink, where there's really no health infrastructure. And we are poaching their healthcare workers to prop up our own failing public services. And they're failing for a number of reasons, including immigration itself. It's like a kind of, you know, self-fulfilling
cure
thing.
Cure the poison, as you point out.
Yes, exactly. So it's really, and that's to say nothing of the, again, sort of with my Marxist hat on, the kind of Western imperialism into the Middle East, for example, that has disrupted and destabilized that region, which has led to displacement of people, which has, you know, in turn led them to seek refuge, you know, often illegitimately, in Europe.
So there's an interesting sort of dovetailing here in the advance of medicine. It's not that society is actually that much less dangerous than it used to be. It's just that people survive from violence.
Yes.
A far greater.
This was Steven Pinker's sleight of hand in his better, the Better Angels of Our Nature book.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's like, oh, we die a lot less than we used to. Yeah, because we can save a lot more people from dying.
Exactly. But if you're in a third world country that just has naturally a much higher rate of violence. Mm-hmm. And we are stealing all of your highly trained doctors.
Yeah. Or disease.
Yeah. Or disease, yeah. Or whatever it is. But, you know, you can see how, like you say, this takes on the aspect of a predatory and extractive system.
And one would think that any self-respecting leftist would look at those countries, which are genuinely in a terrible state where people are dying and there's immense human suffering, and they think, actually, you know, maybe I shouldn't be supporting this project of exporting all of their labor to my country to prop up my quality of life.
And it is so genuinely extractive as well, just from purely a materialistic perspective, where it's like, look, those countries paid and raised and trained those people.
Yeah.
All of the resources that required to make a doctor in Uganda or whatever, we're just pinching for £40,000-£50,000 a year or something like that. Which, that's, you know, we're stealing
something. And how are they expected to compete when we have such a more powerful economy and are able to offer these people such a better quality of life?
I'm going to have to drag us away from this wet sentimentality that the two of you are engaging in right now. And point out as well, a significant number of these will have been done on completely illegitimate grounds.
That's also true.
That is true, but that's the right-wing view.
Yes.
I guess I have to be the right-winger as usual, Carl.
But the point is to, like, from the left's own premises, and from their own concerns.
And that's how I'm approaching this.
Which is just totally fair, because, you know, if you are a leftist watching this, what are your answers to any of these things?
Yeah. Well, and that brings us to point number four, which is that mass immigration
But seriously though, also, what's the left's response supposed to be? That, well, I mean, a lot of these people are coming in here illegitimately on fake, well, not on fake visas, but illegitimate visas because they've lied about their qualifications, and they will actively admit it online. Just filling in my cousin's university forms, just doing the exams for them, doing all of this for them. What's their response to that? They don't have one.
No, really. But they don't care about that.
That's the point. They just wouldn't care. Whereas challenges them on their own grounds, and they then have nothing to say, right? Which brings us to point four, which is that mass immigration is bourgeois virtue signaling. Now, I don't think I need to necessarily explain that. It's obviously true that the managerial middle class who run our country,
are a party.
The professionals who run society in the West, it makes them feel warm and fuzzy when they go to bat for mass immigration. And when they facilitate it, because they think it makes them a moral person, and it's at the expense of the well-being of the working class.
But moreover, it's also at the expense of the well-being of the people that they're bringing in, because there is an implicit class dynamic between this. Who's going to serve our coffee at Pret? Mm-hmm. Who are our new proletariats that we're importing because we don't like the white proletariat? Yeah.
Who's going to clean your toilet, Donald Trump?
Exactly.
Great quote.
It is explicitly hierarchical.
And
exploitative and domination. If you're a leftist, you can't deny these aspects to it.
No,
in fact,
not.
And if you do, okay, tell us why. Tell us what your argument is.
And the final point, which I think kind of encapsulates everything I've spoken about so far, to use the language of Louis Althusser, is that mass immigration itself is a repressive state apparatus. Mm-hmm. Because if you have an indigenous English working class who feel they're being mistreated, or they can strike, or they can organize, or whatever else, right? They can demand better pay, better working conditions, and all the rest of it. But if you allow mass immigration, you can make those people irrelevant by just replacing them, right? So the message they receive is, get in line, or you're getting replaced. Get in line, or you're going to lose your job, you're going to lose your livelihood, and all the rest of it. And in order to keep those people in line, as we saw with the case of Lucy Connolly earlier today, the ideological state apparatus of the British state exists almost solely at this point to prop up the narrative that mass immigration is good for our society. You know, whether it's the media or the education system or whatever else, all of these mouthpieces of power, they tell the working class that mass immigration is good for them, despite the fact that their eyes tell them that it isn't, and their pay packets tell them that it isn't, and the price of housing tells them that it isn't. And so, mass immigration is actually a weapon of the state. It's a weapon of capital. It's a weapon of people who are, you know, ultimately self-interested, who want to make themselves feel good and line their own pockets at the expense of basically everyone else in society.
And if you are any kind of leftist who claims to care about the working class, again, as far as I'm concerned, this is just an open and shut case.
And if I may, just as a conclusion, the post-woke left who I spoke about last time I was on the show, people like Gary Stevenson and so on, Stevenson has addressed the issue of immigration, but says he did a whole video in it. And it's quite a good video, as his videos often are, to the chagrin of the audience, no doubt.
I've watched any, so I don't know.
But he says basically that immigration is just a distraction tactic by the capitalist class. And I just think that if you're saying that, you're not... Yeah, you're not a radical. If you're prepared to defend the project of mass immigration, then you're kicking at an open door, right? If you're just going to say it's inequality, well, okay, if it is inequality, what's causing the inequality? Who's causing the inequality? Yeah. And so I think
he's the insufferable lefty on Twitter posting the picture of the
cookie and
the cookie saying, hey, that immigrant wants your cookie. Yeah. That's not the point. The actual is
I'm going to give him your cookie.
Yeah, he needs your cookie more than you do. Because when you talk about the working class, a lot of the left these days, unless they are very old school Labour style leftists from 100 years ago, they see it as an international global working class. Yes. Well, yeah, some guy in the slums of Manchester might have it hard, but does he have it as hard as a starving child in Africa? That's the way that they look at it. Stelios has explained it quite well in the wealth transfer of, well, we need some kind of equitable wealth transfer and redistribution, but it has to basically be across the entire world.
Yeah. So just as a quick thing here, so what's interesting about this is how the liberals have managed to kind of one-up the classical Marxists, right? Because it used to be the Marxists had the edge on the liberals quite significantly by saying, well, look, you concede that it's private property that creates inequality. You say you're for equality, therefore private property has to be the thing that goes. And now the liberals have got one-up on the Marxists. So even like someone like Gary Stevenson has got to be like, well, I can't possibly criticize mass immigration because of universal liberal human rights. And what I'm essentially forced to do is dodge the issue and just say, oh, it's those guys who are using them as a tool in order to destroy the economy.
And this is the brilliant trick that the capitalist class has played on the left itself. They've co-opted them, captured them, and are using them to their own ends. And so I think if the post-woke left want to be a serious force and a seriously radical force, they need to reckon with these critiques, and they need to recognize that so much of their kind of their instinctual liberalism when it comes to things like immigration and other social issues, actually it's in the interests of the capitalist class that they're seeking to tear down that they continue to go to bat for these things. So I think they need to break with this stuff completely and come and join us.
So I actually, just a quick end thing here, I don't think they're going to be able to do it.
The
woke liberalism that we talk about is the consequence of the synthesis of Marxist class dynamics applied to non-economic factors, therefore rendering a kind of synthesis of old Marxism and modern liberalism, which means that essentially they would have to admit that they were reactionaries in order to do it. So I think that they're in a bind there and they can't go anywhere. But again, if you're a leftist, let me know. You know, I'm open to changing my mind. Anyway, the Habsification says, has anyone seen the Google VO3 AI videos? Yeah, they're insane.
Yeah, they're wild. Yeah,
it's something to talk about next week, probably.
It's kind of like modern CGI, though. You can still detect that it's CG because there's still the uncanny valley about
now.
It. Yeah, for now.
Iteration.
The one that I saw earlier was they put it through the Will Smith eating spaghetti test.
Yeah.
And it's done a much better job than they used to.
And the thing is, like, so, you know, when you guys get to my age, there's a fear that you'll end up being the boomer who can't identify the slop on Facebook, right? And
for now, I think the easiest way to tell, even when they've merged it with actual footage, is the mouth movement is very unnatural and slightly blurred. So we'll see how they develop that.
There was one where this guy was interviewing a girl on the street. And
I saw that one, yeah.
Very convincing until you start looking at her mouth and it's very slightly...
It's like desynced almost.
Not necessarily desynced. It was just kind of like
mouth flappy.
Yeah, like it was mechanical or something. But I could totally, like, I didn't notice it at first.
Oh yeah, that's going to get the boomers.
Well, yeah, that's the point. And I was like, Christ, at first I didn't see that this was AI.
Oh no, there's going to be next level Nigerian prince scams coming up for those poor boomers when they can't identify that the Nigerian prince video is AI.
That's terrible. But the thing is, like, I'm really worried about retweeting something that's just AI slop and not realizing it's AI slop. Because I think I'm pretty good at identifying it. But like the day is getting closer when I'm the boomer on Facebook who gets one-shotted by
know. We all need to be following Carl on Twitter so that we can be there for that day.
I'm really worried about it because the thing is, again, these things are getting so good that it is actually really hard to see. And you know, it'll come for you too. It'll be you one day. Amila says, I used to vote SNP, now I want a revival of the British Empire. Well, the argument for the British Empire has actually never been stronger, has it? Mm-hmm. Really, if you think about it.
Also, the Scottish were overrepresented in the British Empire as well. Yeah. So that's actually the classical Scottish position you've taken there.
Yes. Absolutely is, and I'm so sick of the Scottish victim narrative on the British Empire. It's like, You liars.
You loved it.
It's no, but it's very similar to the feminists with the patriarchy, right? Oh, no. White women absolutely loved it when they had plantations, right? They were totally on board,
yeah.
Right? They had all the wealth and the riches, and they had, like, you know, various levels of servants and stuff. And then suddenly, oh, and Bill Burr's got a great thing where they just step over the fence and go, oh, yeah, we've always been oppressed by the patriarchs. Like, no, get back over here.
Yeah.
You know, you bloody liars. You know, and it's the same with the Scots and the British Empire. Don't. We know, okay? We've got all the receipts, actually. Mm. We know the percentage of the Scots. Like, Scots make up a massively disproportionate percentage of colonial governors.
Because they were really good at it.
They
were.
Hey, you know, that's why we were like,
you Scots, I mean, Dutton's been saying about, like, per capita, the Scottish are the most, like, genius, gifted people in the world, which is quite remarkable. Fair on you.
Remarkable talent.
So if you put the needle down, maybe save the book fast for the weekends, you can go back to being a great country.
Yeah. All we're saying is the opportunity will be available in the future. No. Cranky Texan says, it seems woke right is a framework that Lindsay created while he was working on an identity crisis with the Daily Wire to go after people who disagree with certain Middle East policies. Money talks. Lindsay uses Israel and Jewish people as the canary in the coal mine, as in, if you have any critiques of Israel, then you've gone off the liberal plantation.
Well, I mean, that was, what's his name? I was about to say Les Grossman. That's the character from Tropic Thunder. Vasily Grossman.
Close enough.
Vasily Grossman, he, I think, is the one who basically said that. And Douglas Murray likes to use him over and over again as well. But Vasily Grossman was a Soviet propagandist during the Second World War who was complicit in covering up all of the atrocities that they were committing. So it's interesting how the neocons, very happy to just, like, parrot Soviet-era propaganda talking points when it's convenient for them.
Yeah. The point being, essentially, Lindsay, what he's trying to do is make sure nobody ever criticizes liberalism. I'm not having it. Basically. And Alex says, ConchPoints was playing this hierarchy game with Vorsch in regards to intersectionality. ConchPoints is the leftist who wanted her coffee from Pret. Avoid Philosophy Tube, of course. I don't know. I've watched a lot of ContraPoints videos, actually.
There is also some deep lore between Philosophy Tube and ContraPoint.
That is also true.
Allegedly.
But the I don't know if ContraPoints is actually the one who wanted her coffee from Pret. I think ContraPoints is a disappointed idealist, actually, when it comes to leftism, because they are smart, and I think they do understand the inherent inability of leftism to ever accomplish its goals, and so the descent back into sort of cynicism and sarcasm and, you know, comedy is a coping mechanism for that.
I've never watched either of them.
I've
seen people respond to them.
I watch. You've got to know your enemy. Right?
Of the three of those, the most I've interacted with is Vorsch, and mainly to watch him go into red-faced, spittle-flecking rage arguing with you that one time.
Yeah, I don't know why he was so angry. I didn't know who he was.
He came straight out of the gate, furious at you.
I didn't know who he was. I was just like, what have I done? Did I shag his girlfriend or something? Like,
he'd probably like that, to be fair.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah, probably, yeah.
and you wouldn't.
No.
If that picture that goes around is him and his girlfriend.
But Matt says, Carl, Watch the Skies is a Swedish movie that used an Avid AI plugin to change the mouth flaps and had Swedish actors re-record the dialogue in English to release the movie in the US. Yeah, I've said this before. Basically, AI is going to make it so that you go to the computer and say, I want to watch a movie about, you know, war or something. And it'll just, okay, sit down, got your movie ready, and it'll be a completely tailored experience for you. You won't know that it's not, like, a fully, you know, fully done Hollywood movie, because it'll look perfect and it will drive us all apart, because actually a huge amount of social interaction is shared experiences.
Yeah,
I hate that idea. Not for the shared experiences stuff, that's gay. More because art should be exclusive. It should be the exclusive realm of people who are exceptional enough to produce exceptional art.
Sure,
computers is just going to be a complete, even greater sloppification.
That is a good argument, but, like, when you think about it, so much of your interaction with other people is just talking about the shared artistic experience.
That's also true.
You know, when you're talking about music,
tune in for the Breaking Bad Lads hour in about 45 minutes.
Yeah,
music, movies, television shows, you know, any books, any novels, you know, anything like that will all be taken away from you. You'll have nothing to talk about because you'll be like,
and you
see that AI thing that I generated yesterday. No, of course they didn't.
Yeah. And it arises out of that kind of individualistic mindset, doesn't it? Where the only thing that matters is just me, you know,
pure consumption.
What satisfies me.
Yep.
You know, and it's really depressing.
Ultimate utilitarian liberty.
I think
it's evil.
All art except that sponsored by aristocrats should be banned. We need to go back to a system of pure patronage.
Yeah.
My aristocrats. Aristocrats on my side.
Yes, of course.
Art sponsored by ContraPoints.
What? What?
Well, that's what you're arguing for. Art sponsored by ContraPoints.
Why by ContraPoints isn't on my side?
Yeah, I didn't say on your side, but you're art by aristocrats. Okay, well, who are the modern day aristocrats? Unfortunately,
I do not think ContraPoints is an aristocrat.
Well, by any sort of modern metric, I think they are. That's the problem. So, unfortunately, we're getting ContraPoints art now. Thanks.
Or certainly the mouthpiece of aristocrats.
No. ContraPoints would be the person who is sponsored.
Maybe.
By them. I mean, did ContraPoints get money from the government during COVID? I
don't know.
I bet, that was they're American, aren't they?
Yeah. But the point is, it's that's, you know, where the George Soros money will go. It's, oh god damn it. Anyway, let's go to the comments.
All of these suggestions are once we have won.
Yeah.
Until then, I go to their principles and we appeal to their principles until we win.
Hang on a second.
What's going on?
Talk amongst yourselves.
Let's turn this up. We've got some very high-tech speakers.
Don't show people the magic.
All right, I've turned it up. Do you want to play it now?
Just another follow-up to Harry Sigman in the music industry. A preponderance of writers and producers everywhere is really functionally the accreditation rules for royalties spawning from the musicians' unions. Turns out if all the money is in accreditation, being a part of the act is actually kind of ancillary. This is called the Nashville Writers' Room model, which grew out of the country scene in America. As a function, all these modern artists don't actually own any of the fancy mansions. It's all built into the contract and is owned by the record company, which is actually given to them as a debt. And finally, the business has always been a cartel. I have it on good authority from someone who was playing the game at the time that a book called Hitman by Frank Dannon is an authoritative source on the matter, though the blackmailing sex cults is a more recent innovation.
Hitman by Frederick Dannon. I will check that book out. Thank you, because that seems to conform a lot to my experiences and understanding. What I used to do as a teenager, which is how I got a lot of the information that I do about the music industry, not many people do this anymore, is read magazines. And in the magazines, they would always have these big articles talking about how so-and-so artists from the 60s and the 70s managed to produce one particular album that's a very famous album. And it was always amazing to me back then just how much of it was determined entirely behind the scenes by wrangling with the record labels, even in this time of great artistic freedom.
Really? Mm.
Which is why I felt the need to make the segment that I did last week, because seeing that there were still so many people who seemed to be under the misapprehension that music was just a case of, at least until recently, the people just got discovered because they were amazing, and then they got
meritocratic.
Yeah, it was just pure meritocracy.
This is my innocent view of the music industry. Yeah, I've never been.
Yeah, was just clearly wrong, because even a band that is really fantastic and was very innovative for its time, like Led Zeppelin, their guitarist, Jimmy Page, set them up as basically an industry band because he'd been part of bands before. He'd been a very successful session musician working on behalf of the record companies. So he's like, I want to do my own original music. So he headhunts the best musicians that he can find to get an already agreed upon record deal for what is essentially an industry band. The critics hated them, but they went on to be very successful. But it's very interesting how people, if you didn't know that, you'd just think that Led Zeppelin, they were just a band that were really, really talented, that appeared out of nowhere, and the record labels had to snap them up because they were just that damn good. But I'll check that book out, thank you very much. And that is another interesting thing as well, which is that if you work for a record label, you don't own your own music.
Mm.
This is one of the reasons that Michael Jackson was in so much trouble during the 90s.
Fight with like Sony to get like half the label or something.
I think he owned half of Sony Music by the end of his life, and also owned all of the Beatles catalog.
Yeah.
But he had to fight very, very hard to get even the rights to his own music.
This is
something like the Sex Pistols, going back to the 1970s, they had to fight really hard because they didn't have any of the rights to their music. So that's one of the reasons the record labels want so much control over it, because it's once it's been released and once it's been licensed out under them, it's not your music anymore, it's their music.
Something makes you wonder about the stuff about Michael Jackson, though, right? If, like, he's engaged in a power struggle with the record label. Oh, here are a bunch of allegations. Oh, he's died of a heart attack, guys.
Razor Fist actually has some very, very good videos.
I watched this video on it, and I was just like, there are questions.
To be fair, just very quickly on this topic, Harry, I missed your segment, so apologies if I'm repeating a point. But I always kind of had a sort of implicit sense that there was some kind of coordination that went on in the music industry, just based on the fact that, you know, through my teenage years, for example, I noticed that all pop music just sounded like the same factory-produced trash.
Well, the biggest example of this, I mean, you can point to any number of industry plant acts. One of the most telling examples was, do you remember that awful...
You're not going to shit on S Club 7, are you?
Do you remember that awful song Friday by Rebecca Black that became a big... they did have a hit written by one of the industry songwriters. Rebecca Black was just some girl whose dad was rich. And I think he just literally went to a record label and bought her a hit single. That was written for her and released by a record label who did all the marketing for her, and it was inescapable.
How much does that cost?
I don't know. But there's also examples of... there's a guy called Max Martin. His surname is Sandberger. He's a Swedish songwriter who in the past 30 years has written 27...
I think I saw that going around, actually.
I'm the one who shared it in the first place, and other people were stealing my screenshots, the bastards. Yeah, he wrote 27 number one hits over the past 30 years for people like Taylor Swift, Ariana Grande...
That's why they all sound the same, right?
The Weeknd. So my point was that when you listen to these acts and these particular songs, what you're not listening to are individual artists expressing themselves. You're listening to this guy and his production team with different interchangeable faces. And you go back to the 50s and you have the Motown system, which was very explicit about this, where they had a team of songwriters, they had professional bands playing everything, and the people who were the named acts were just faces who could sing. And that's how that system worked. Now you don't even really need them to be able to sing, because you've got auto-tune. So you just
saying my time has come.
Yes, Carl. You just need to start looks-maxing, and then you're ready for it. Because they just need you to be a pretty, marketable face who's going to be very compliant.
Well, someone like Sabrina Carpenter seems to me to be like the prime example.
I hate to drag this back on the subject, but this is a wider conversation that would be interesting to have. Scott says, just sending appreciation of Charlie's appearance on LBC. Calm, cool, and collected. Major points well.
Cheers.
And Miller says, the main issues of Scotland are the Westminster politicians. Party's not really interested in Britain, and either they're in charge of it. Well, I mean, God, that's the problem we've all got, isn't it, mate? We're all in that bloody boat. And on that note, I do actually feel sympathy for the Scottish who are like, maybe independence could help. And say, yeah, but your parties were woke. Worse. Like, weirdly enough, like, wasn't it, was it Boris or Rishi who had to basically rein them in on the woman definition and stuff like that?
Yeah, I remember that.
That's just not happening. It's like, that's for your own good. Anyway, let's go to the next one.
Hello, Otis Eaters. I'm currently at the Reform UK pub in Blackpool. I've just spoken to the owner and a few people in it. They love the place. The local Reform branch meets upstairs. Good prices. Lovely working class people. It's a great place. And Charlie Downs, great interview.
Thank you very much. Cheers. Yeah, I know people who've been to that pub, and apparently it is actually quite... I mean, it's super cheap, apparently.
Really? So,
yeah.
Okay. Well, that's won me over. let's get to the next one.
Friday Art Journey update. I started a new project where I try to draw my version of the Nordic gods. And this is quite interesting because I need them to look recognizably like the Nordic gods, but not too much like other very popular versions of it. And I actually think the restrictions made me make something quite interesting in my life. I quite like it. So remember to follow me on X or Tumblr, give me hints, tell me what to do, give requests. I have only drawn since October, so I'm actually really new at this. But I think I'm doing pretty good.
I was quite impressed. But
I'm great. Better than what I could do.
Way better than what I could do. Let's go to the next one.
Happy Friday, Lotus Eaters.
do enjoy shooting ranges.
Nice.
Solid.
Look like good fun.
Yeah, yeah.
What?
Rape Panape.
The most popular program television ever made.
Rape Panape.
Some what? People are sexually aroused by the idea of violence of a sexual nature being carried out against primates. I'm not. But some people are, and that's... It was good that a program existed for those people.
And by 2010, this show dominated the ratings.
I'm sorry, I can't come out. Rape an Ape is on.
Okay.
Well. I don't even know what to say to that. Wow.
I'm going to need to find whatever program that's taken from.
To be fair, I think he's making a good case for political correctness at this point.
Yeah.
Hey guys, last couple of weeks people have been sending me messages on my website asking for advice on how to get self-published, and I've only just seen them right now. I've been so busy with so many other things, but I've responded to them. They should be in your inbox. So sorry that it's taken me such a long time, and I look forward to working with you.
Okay,
lovely.
Is that the last one? Theodore says, chemical castration is actually way less dramatic than you would imagine. It's not permanent sterilization or disabling of the sex organs. It's an ongoing hormone injection or pills that reduces sex drive. They stop taking the hormones, it all comes back.
Yeah, in my mind, chemical castration is like pouring acid on your genitals.
Yeah, right.
I'm imagining.
I imagine this is going to sound quite psychopathic, but I imagine like James Bond-esque, strapped down to a metal table and they just laser your genitals off.
Not chemical.
it's close enough. I imagine what it is they just basically give you lots of estrogen pills and injections.
Something like that. But the point being is if they want to, they can just choose not to, and then... You know,
yeah.
Derek says, I'm sorry, but just saying bring down the government is not enough to incite violence. If that's the case, Radiohead's No Surprises should ever be played in the UK again. It's when it's point by point, step by step, akin to a recipe or an instruction manual, that's something else entirely.
Well, we had an example of that guy, and he was given a suspended sentence.
Yeah, actually, that's a great point.
Yeah, I think what the inciting violence was her saying burn the hotels down. Yeah. But even then, deleted.
Yeah, but I actually think the For All I Care is an important... extension on the end of that, though, because that's that changes the context for me. I mean, yeah. I appreciate that in the context of there's currently a lot going on, you can see why they would consider that too difficult. But as Jimbo points out here, if I say, quote, free Lucy Connolly for all I care, am I inciting a prison break? And no, not really.
It's definitely muddy. It's definitely muddy.
And like you were saying, like some sort of concern for the human condition when judging this would have been appropriate.
Yeah. And personally, it was obviously a stupid mistake. I wouldn't have had it punished at all.
No, exactly. I wouldn't either, but that Texas gal says, it's crazy to me this is considered a crime in the first place. Yes, but we live in England. Mm. Hector says, the funny thing about Rubio is that he was confirmed by the Senate with something like 100-0. He seems to have entirely deceived the Dems.
Fair play.
I didn't think to look by what his confirmation was. Mm. Actually, I should have done, because that puts that in context. I regret voting for you. It's like, good.
Yeah. there is this idea, I think, that some people think could be viable, which is to kind of infiltrate and then reveal your power level when you're at the highest possible level. I know that. But like, you know, Rubio, it seems like he's had some kind of like conversion. Mm. But it does also show that that kind of thing does happen.
Impressive that you managed to deceive literally all of the Dems.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like, yeah, no, I'm just a milquetoast conservative and I'll do everything you tell me.
Yeah.
And now everyone's getting deported. Omar says, it's rather amusing to note that all the henpecking against Rubio is falling apart simply because he disregards the framing. He doesn't need to make an argument because they aren't making one either. Do you realize that you're a bad person? Capitulate. No, next question. Moreover, they can't get rid of him either, can they, really? He's part of the administration. Mm. Trump was elected. He's been appointed by Trump. He's been confirmed by the Senate. I'm going to do what I like now. I'm here for 4 years.
Yeah.
So get effed. Theodore says, Trump seems to know how to make enemies into allies and accept former rivals as friends. Yeah, this is the most important aspect of any leader, really.
Yeah, totally.
The ability, Mr. Farage, to take people who have been mildly critical of you and turn them into your strongest supporters.
I mean, Rubio was more than mildly critical. He was calling for him to never be able to be president and everything.
I deliberately understated it. Because most of the people that Nigel Farage has cast into wilderness have just been mildly critical of him, and he never got over it. For all of the talk of Trump being just a giant ego on stilts, like, he doesn't demonstrate it when he's dealing with people.
No.
Right? He actually seems to be very, very quick to give out largesse when he's congratulating people or forgiving people and bringing them back into the fold.
Now, I don't know whether that's been something he's been doing for his whole career or whether that's quite a recent thing. But
I don't think this is going to be a recent thing. It's got to be a skill he's honed over, like, 50 years of being a business.
One would think, yeah.
Someone online says, is it Catholic? Yes, keeping our women and children safe is Catholic.
Yeah.
Matthew says, another positive of Rubio is he's fluent in Spanish, so he can browbeat Mexico and Central and South American countries to get in line without a translator. And there's no point calling him a racist over it either, is there? Because he's just like, you know, hola.
Yeah.
Roman Observer says, Marx understood the labor market better than modern Marxists. We call this progress. Well, no, the thing is, modern Marxists are completely on the hook for woke liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
And at this point, basically, they're kind of disabled by it. It's not that they don't understand, it's they can't allow themselves to admit, because then they have to admit, I was fooled. Actually, the Marxist project entirely is kind of nonsense, which we already know, and I can't go anywhere from here and still be a Marxist, at least doctrinarily.
Mm. And those that modern Marxists, I mean, you know, like Thomas Piketty, for example, is like a kind of modern Marxist type person. From what I haven't read his books cover to cover, but from what I understand of what I've sort of heard of him, he's just another kind of like lib, you know, globalist type character. And he casts himself as a Marxist.
They absolutely all are.
Yeah.
Dirty Belt says, Charlie, your work doing freedom of information requests to inform the public is great. Have you considered making any guides explaining how to make such requests? I'd like to start badgering my local council, but I don't know where to get started.
It's a good idea, actually. That's
very good idea.
Yeah. Everyone should be doing that, by the way.
Yeah. There's no reason not to. For some reason, they left that back door in because it seems like the liberal thing to do.
Yeah.
Malicious compliance, folks. Just start making their lives a living hell. Easily.
Totally, yeah.
On that note, we are out of time. Join us in half an hour for our Breaking Bad Lads Hour, where Harry will be giving a spirited defense of Walter White against the evil witch, Skyler White. And
that's not the whole thing, but that is a fair part.
And various other attacks on the narratives that have been going around attacking Walter, the patron saint of straight white drug dealers. Thanks for joining us, folks. We'll see you in half an hour.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com, RiteRug.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.